Madeline's mood flipped from teary back to angry. "Yeah, I don't know if I'd use the word polite," said Ed.
"It's hard enough being a single mother," said Madeline.
What? Said Ed.
"Jane! I'm talking about Jane, of course. I remember Abigail's first day of school. I felt like a freak. It felt like everyone was so disgustingly married. All the parents were in perfect little pairs. I never felt so alone." Madeline thought of her ex-husband today, looking comfortably about the schoolyard. Nathan had no clue as to what it had been like for Madeline for all those years she'd brought Abigail up on her own. He wouldn't deny it. Oh, no. If she were to scream at him, "It was hard, it was so hard," he'd flinch and look so sad and so sorry. But no matter how hard he tried, he would never really get it. She was filled with impotent rage. There was nowhere to aim it, except straight at Renata. "So just imagine how Jane feels when her child is the only one not invited to a party. Imagine it."
"I know," said Ed, "although I guess after what happened, you can sort of see it from Renata's point of view."
"No, you can't," cried Madeline.
"Jesus, sorry, no, of course I can't." Ed looked in the rearview mirror. "Oh, look, here's your poor little friend pulled up behind us. Let's go eat cake with her. That will fix things." He undid his seatbelt.
"If you're not asking every child in the class, you don't hand out the invitations on the playground," said Madeline. "Every mother knows that. It's a law of the land."
"I could talk about this subject all day long," said Ed. "I really could. There is nothing else I want to talk about today other than Amabella's 5th birthday party."
"Shut up," said Madeline.
"I thought we didn't say shut up in our house."
"Fuck off then," said Madeline.
Ed grinned. He put a hand to the side of her face. "You'll feel better tomorrow. You always feel better tomorrow."
"I know. I know."
Madeline took a deep breath and opened the car door to see Jane's mother fling herself out of Jane's car and hurry along the sidewalk toward her, slinging her handbag over her shoulder and smiling frantically.
"Hi. Hi there. Madeline, will you just walk along the beach with me for a bit while the others order our coffee?"
"Mum?" Jane walked behind with her father. "You've seen the beach. You don't even like the beach." You didn't have to be gifted and talented to see that Jane's mother wanted to talk alone with Madeline.
"Of course I will. Die." The name came to her like a gift.
"I'll come too then," sighed Jane.
"No, no. You go into the cafe and help your dad get settled and order something nice for me," said Di.
"Yes, because I'm such a doddering old senior citizen."
Jane's father put on a quavering old man's voice and clutched Jane's arm.
"Help me, darling daughter."
"Off you go," said Di firmly.
Madeline watched Jane struggle with whether or not to insist before giving a tiny shrug and giving up.
"Don't take too long," she said to her mother, "or your coffee will get cold."
"Get me a double shot espresso and the chocolate mud cake with cream," said Madeline to Ed.
Ed gave her a thumbs up and led Jane and her father into Blue Blues, while Madeline reached down and slipped off her shoes. Jane's mother did the same.
"Did your husband take the day off work for Chloe's first day at school?" asked Di as they walked across the sand towards the water. "Oh, goodness, the glare."
She was wearing sunglasses, but she shielded her eyes with the back of her hand.
"He's a journalist for the local paper," said Madeline. "He's got very flexible hours, and he works from home a lot."
"That must be nice. Or is it?"
Does he get under your feet?
Di picked her way unsteadily across the sand.
Sometimes I send Bill off to buy me something at the supermarket I don't really need, just to give myself a little breather.
It works pretty well for us, said Madeline. I work 3 days a week for the Piriwi Peninsula Theatre Company, so Ed can pick the kids up when I'm working. We're not making a fortune, but you know we both love our jobs, so we're happy.
My God, why was she talking about money? It was like she was defending their choice of lifestyles. And to be honest, they didn't love their jobs that much. Was it because she sometimes felt like her whole life was in competition with high-flying career women like Renata? Or was it just because money was on her mind because of that shocking electricity bill she'd opened this morning? The truth was that although they weren't wealthy, they were certainly not struggling. And thanks to Madeline's savvy online shopping skills, even her wardrobe didn't need to suffer.
Ah, yes, money. They say it doesn't buy happiness, but I don't know about that.
Di pushed her hair out of her eyes and looked around the beach.
It is a very pretty beach. We're not really beach people, and obviously no one wants to see this in a bikini.
She made a face of pure loathing and gestured at her perfectly ordinary body, which Madeline judged to be about the same size as her own.
I don't see why not, said Madeline.
She had no patience for this sort of talk. It drove her to distraction the way women wanted to bond over self-hatred.
But it will be nice for Jane and Ziggy living near the beach, I think, I guess. And, you know, I just really wanted to thank you, Madeline, for taking Jane under your wing the way you have.
She took her sunglasses off and looked directly at Madeline. Her eyes were pale blue, and she was wearing a frosted pink eyeshadow, which wasn't quite working for her, although Madeline approved of the effort.
Well, of course, said Madeline. It's hard when you move to a new area and you don't know anyone.
Yes, and Jane has moved so often in the last few years. Ever since she had Ziggy, she can't seem to stay put or find a nice circle of friends. And she'd kill me for saying this. It's just, I'm not sure what's really going on with her.
She stopped, looked back over her shoulder at the cafe, and compressed her lips.
It's hard when they stop telling you things, isn't it? Said Madeline after a moment. I have a teenage daughter from a previous relationship.
She always felt compelled to clarify this when she spoke about Abigail, and then felt obscurely guilty for doing so. It was like she was separating Abigail out somehow, putting her into a different category.
I don't know why I was so shocked when Abigail stopped telling me things. That's what all teenagers do, right? But she was such an open little girl. Of course, Jane isn't a teenager.
It was like she'd given Di permission to speak freely. She turned to her enthusiastically.
I know. She's 24. A grown-up. But they never seem like grown-ups. Her dad tells me I'm worrying over nothing. It's true that Jane is doing a beautiful job bringing up Ziggy, and she supports herself. Won't take a cent from us. I slip money into her pockets like a pickpocket, or the opposite of a pickpocket. But she's changed. Something has changed. I can't put my finger on it. It's like this deep unhappiness that she tries to hide. I don't know if it's depression or drugs or an eating disorder or what. She got so painfully thin. She used to be quite voluptuous.
Well, said Madeline, thinking, if it's an eating disorder, you probably gave it to her.
Why am I telling you this? Said Di. You won't want to be her friend anymore. You'll think she's a drug addict. She's not a drug addict. She only has 3 out of the top 10 signs of drug addiction.
or four, at the most. You can't believe what you read on the internet, anyway.
Madeline laughed. And Di laughed, too.
Sometimes I feel like waving my hand in front of her eyes and saying, Jane, Jane, are you still in there?
I'm pretty sure she hasn't had a boyfriend since before Ziggy was born. She broke up with this boy, Zach. We all loved Zach. Gorgeous boy. And Jane was very upset over the breakup. Very upset. But God, that was, what, 6 years ago now? She couldn't still be grieving over Zach, could she? He wasn't that good looking.
I don't know, said Madeline. She wondered wistfully if her coffee was sitting on the table up at Blue Blue's, getting cold.
Next thing, she's pregnant, and supposedly Zach isn't the father, although we did always wonder about that. But she was absolutely adamant that Zach was not the father. She said it over and over again. A one-night stand, she said. No way of contacting the father.
Well, you know, she was halfway through her arts law degree. It wasn't ideal, but everything happens for a reason, don't you think?
Absolutely, said Madeline, who did not believe that at all. She'd been told by a doctor that she was likely to have a lot of trouble falling pregnant naturally, so it just seemed like it was meant to be. And then my darling dad died while Jane was pregnant, and that's why it seemed like his soul might have come back in...
Mom! Madeline!
Jane's mother startled, and they both turned away from the sea to see Jane standing on the boardwalk outside Blue Blue's, waving frantically.
Your coffee is ready.
Coming, called Madeline.
I'm sorry, said Di as they walked back up from the beach. I talk too much. Can you please forget everything I said? It's just that when I saw poor little Ziggy didn't get asked to that child's birthday party, I felt like crying. I'm so emotional these days. And then we had to get up so early today. I'm feeling quite light-headed. I didn't used to be. I used to be quite hard-headed. It's my age. I'm 58. My friends are the same. We went out for lunch the other day. We've been friends since our children started kindergarten. We were all talking about how we feel like 15-year-olds, weeping at the drop of a hat.
Madeline stopped walking. Di, she said. Di smiled nervously, as if she were about to be told off.
Yes?
I'll keep an eye on Jane, she said. I promise. Gabrielle. See, part of the problem was that Madeline sort of adopted Jane. She was like a crazy, protective big sister. If you ever said anything even mildly critical of her Jane, you'd have Madeline snarling at you like a rabid dog. Chapter 20. It was 11 a.m. on the first day of Ziggy's school life. Had he already had his morning tea by now? Was he eating his apple and his cheese and crackers? His tiny box of raisins? Jane's heart twisted at the thought of him carefully opening his new lunchbox. Where would he sit? Who would he talk to? She hoped Chloe and the twins were playing with him, but they could just as easily be ignoring him. It wasn't like one of the twins would stroll up to Ziggy, hand outstretched, and say,
Why, hello, Ziggy, isn't it? We met a few weeks back at a playdate. How have you been?
She stood up from the dining room table where she was working and stretched her arms high above her head. He'd be fine. Every child went to school. They survived. They learned the rules of life. She went into the tiny kitchen of her new apartment to switch the kettle on for a cup of tea she didn't especially feel like. It was just an excuse to take a break from the accounts of Perfect Pete's plumbing. Pete might be a perfect plumber, but he wasn't that great at keeping his paperwork in order. Every quarter, she received a shoebox filled with an odd assortment of scrunched, smudged, strange-smelling paperwork. Invoices, credit card bills, and receipts, most of which were not claimable. She could just imagine Pete emptying out his pockets, scooping up all the receipts from the console of his car in one meaty hand, stomping around his house, grabbing every piece of paper he could find, before stuffing the lot into the shoebox with a gusty sigh of relief. Job done. She went back to the dining room table and picked up the next receipt. Perfect Pete's wife had just spent $335 at the beautician, where she had enjoyed the classic facial, deluxe pedicure, and a bikini line wax. So that was nice for Perfect Pete's wife. Next was an unsigned permission note for a school excursion to Taronga Zoo last year. On the back of the permission note, a child had written in purple crayon, "I hate Tom." Jane studied the permission note. "I will not, be able to attend the excursion as a parent helper." Perfect Pete's wife had already circled, "will not." Too busy getting her bikini line done. The kettle boiled. She crumpled the receipt and permission slip in her hand and walked back into the kitchen. She could be a parent helper if Ziggy ever went on an excursion. After all, that was why she'd originally decided to become a bookkeeper, so she could be flexible for Ziggy and balance motherhood and career. Even though she always felt foolish and fraudulent when she said things like that, as if she weren't really a mother, as if her whole life were a fake. It would be fun to go on a school excursion again. She could still remember the excitement, the treats on the bus. Jane could secretly observe Ziggy interact with the other children, make sure he was normal. Of course he was normal. She thought again, as she had been all morning, of the pale pink envelopes. So many of them. It didn't matter that he wasn't invited to the party. He was too little to feel hurt, and none of the children knew one another yet anyway. It was silly to even think about it. But the truth was, she felt deeply hurt on his behalf, and somehow responsible, as if she'd messed up. She'd been so ready to forget all about the incident on orientation day, and now it was back at the forefront of her mind again. The kettle boiled. If Ziggy really had hurt Amabella, and if he did something like that again, he would never get invited to any parties. The teachers would call her in for a meeting. She would have to take him to see a child psychologist. She would have to say out loud all her secret terrors about Ziggy. Her hand shook as she poured the hot water into the mug. "If Ziggy isn't invited, then Chloe isn't going," Madeline had said at coffee this morning. "Please don't do that," Jane had said. "You're going to make things worse." But Madeline just raised her eyebrows and shrugged. "I've already told Renata." Jane had been horrified. Great. Now Renata would have even more reason to dislike her. Jane would have an enemy. The last time she had had anything close to an enemy, she was in primary school herself. It had never crossed her mind that sending your child to school would be like going back to school yourself. Perhaps she should have made him apologize that day, and she should have apologized herself. "I'm so sorry," she should have said to Renata. "I'm terribly sorry. He's never done anything like this before. I will make sure it never happens again." But it was no use. Ziggy said he didn't do it. She couldn't have reacted any other way. She took the cup of tea back to the dining room table, sat back down at her computer, and unwrapped a new piece of gum. Right. Well, she would volunteer for anything on offer at the school. Apparently, parental involvement was good for your child's education, although she'd always suspected that was propaganda put out by the school. She would try to make friends with other mothers, apart from Madeline and Celeste, and if she ran into Renata, she would be polite and friendly.
"This will all blow over in a week," her father had said at coffee this morning when they were discussing the party.
"Or it will all blow up," said Madeline's husband, Ed. "Now that my wife is involved."
Jane's mother had laughed as if she'd known Madeline and her propensities for years. What had they been talking about for so long on the beach? Jane inwardly squirmed at the thought of her mother revealing every concern she had about Jane's life.
"She can't seem to get a boyfriend. She's so skinny. She won't get a good haircut."
Madeline had fiddled with a heavy silver bracelet around her wrist.
"Kaboom!"
she'd said suddenly, and swirled her hands in opposite directions to indicate an explosion, her eyes wide. Jane had laughed, even while she thought, "Great, I've made friends with a crazy lady." The only reason Jane had had an enemy in primary school was because it was decreed to be so by a pretty, charismatic girl called Emily Berry, who always wore red ladybug hair clips in her hair. Was Madeline the 40-year-old version of Emily Berry? Champagne instead of lemonade? Bright red lipstick instead of strawberry-flavoured lip gloss? The sort of girl who merrily stirred up trouble for you, and you still loved her. Jane shook her head to clear it. This was ridiculous. She was a grown-up. She was not going to end up in the principal's office like she had when she was 10. Emily had sat up on the chair next to her, kicking her legs, chewing gum, and grinning over at Jane whenever the principal looked the other way, as if it were all a great lark.
"Right. Focus."
She picked up the next document from Pete the plumber's shoebox and held it carefully with her fingertips. It was greasy to touch. This was an invoice from a wholesale plumbing supplier. "Oh, well done, Pete. This actually relates to your business." She rested her hands on the keyboard.
"Come on. Ready, set, go."
In order for the data inputting side of her job to be both profitable and bearable, she had to work fast. The first time an accountant gave her a job, he told her it was about 6 to 8 hours work. She'd done it in 4, charged him for 6. Since her first job, she'd gotten even faster. It was like playing a computer game, seeing if she could get to a higher level each time. It wasn't her dream job, but she did quite enjoy the satisfaction of transforming a messy pile of paperwork into neat rows of figures. She loved calling up her clients, who were now mostly small business people like Pete, and telling them she'd found a new deduction. Best of all, she was proud of the fact that she'd supported herself and Ziggy for the last 5 years without having to ask her parents for money, even if it had meant that she sometimes worked well into the night while he slept. This was not the career she'd dreamed of as an ambitious 17-year-old, but now it was hard to remember ever feeling innocent and audacious enough to dream of a certain type of life, as if you got to choose how things turned out. A seagull squawked, and for a moment she was confused by the sound. Well, she'd chosen this. She'd chosen to live by the beach, as if she had as much right as anyone else. She could reward herself for 2 hours' work with a walk on the beach. A walk on the beach in the middle of the day. She could go back to Blue Blues, buy a coffee to go, and then take an arty photo of it, sitting on a fence with the sea in the background, and post it on Facebook with a comment, "Work break. How lucky am I?" People would write, "Jealous." If she packaged the perfect Facebook life, maybe she would start to believe it herself. Or she could even post, "Mad as hell. Ziggy the only one in the class not invited to a birthday party. Grrr." And everyone would write comforting things like, "WTF?" and, Aw, poor little Ziggy. She could shrink her fears down into innocuous little status updates that drifted away on the news feeds of her friends. Then she and Ziggy would be normal people. Maybe she'd even go on a date. Keep Mum happy. She picked up her mobile phone and read the text her friend Anna had sent yesterday. Remember Greg? My cousin you met when we were like 15? He's moved to Sid. Wants your number to ask you for a drink. Okay? No pressure. He's pretty hot now. Got my genes. Ha ha. Kiss. Right. She remembered Greg. He'd been shy, short, reddish hair. He'd made a lame joke that no one got, and then when everyone said, "What? What?" he'd said, "Don't worry about it." That had stuck in her head because she'd felt sorry for him. Why not? She could handle a drink with Greg. It was time. Ziggy was in school. She lived by the beach. She sent back the text. Okay. Kiss. She took a sip of her tea and put her hands on the keyboard. It was her body that reacted. She wasn't even thinking about the text. She was thinking about Pete the plumber's receipt for wastes and plugs. A violent swoop of nausea made her fold in two, her forehead resting against the desk. She pressed her palm across her mouth. Blood rushed from her head. She could smell that scent. She could swear it was real, that it was actually here in the apartment. Sometimes, if Ziggy's mood changed too fast without warning, from happy to angry, she could smell it on him. She half straightened, gagging, and picked up her phone. She texted Anna with shaky fingers. "Don't give it to him. Change my mind." The text came back almost instantly. "Too late." Smiley face. Thea. I heard Jane had a quote-unquote fling with one of the fathers. I've no idea which one. Except I know it wasn't my husband. Bonnie. She did not. Carol. You know, there was a man in their erotic book club. Not my husband, thank goodness. He only reads Golf Australia. Jonathan. Yes, I was the man in the so-called erotic book club, except that was just a joke. It was a book club. A perfectly ordinary book club. Melissa. Didn't Jane have an affair with the stay-at-home dad? Gabrielle. It wasn't Jane who had the affair. I always thought she was born again. Flat shoes, no jewelry, no makeup. But good body. Not an ounce of fat. She was the skinniest mother in the school. God, I'm hungry. Have you tried the 5-2 diet? This is my fast day. I'm dying of starvation. Chapter 21. Celeste arrived early for school pickup. She ached for her twins' compact little bodies, and for that all too brief moment when their hands curled suffocatingly, possessively around her neck, and she kissed their hot, hard, fragrant little heads before they squirmed away. But she knew she would probably be yelling at them within 15 minutes. They'd be tired and crazy. She couldn't get them to sleep until 9 p.m. last night. Much too late. Bad mother. "Just go to sleep!" she'd ended up shrieking. She always had trouble getting them to bed at a reasonable hour, except when Perry was at home. They listened to Perry. He was a good dad. A good husband, too, most of the time. "You need a bedtime routine," her brother had said on the phone from Auckland today, and Celeste had said, "Oh, what a revolutionary idea. I would never have thought of it." If parents had children who were good sleepers, they assumed this was due to their good parenting, not good luck. They followed the rules, and the rules had been proven to work. Celeste must therefore not be following the rules. And you could never prove it to them. They would die smug in their beds. Hi, Celeste. Celeste startled. It's Jane. She pressed a hand to her chest. As usual, she'd been dreaming and hadn't heard footsteps. It bugged her the way she kept jumping like a lunatic when people appeared. Sorry, said Jane. I didn't mean to creep up on you. How was your day? Asked Celeste. Did you get lots of work done? She knew that Jane supported herself doing bookkeeping work. Celeste imagined her sitting at a tidy desk in her small, bare apartment. She hadn't been there, but she knew the block of plain red brick apartments on Beaumont Street down by the beach, and she assumed inside would be unadorned, like Jane. No fuss, no knick-knacks. The simplicity of her life seemed so compelling. Just Jane and Ziggy. One sweet, putting aside the strange choking incident, of course, quiet, dark-haired child. No fights. Life would be calm and uncomplicated. I got a bit done, said Jane. Her mouth made tiny little mouse-like movements as she chewed gum. I had a coffee this morning with my parents and Madeline and Ed. Then the day sort of disappeared. The day goes so fast, agreed Celeste, although hers had dragged. Are you going back to work now that the kids are at school? Asked Jane. What did you do before the twins? I was a lawyer, said Celeste. I was someone else. Huh. I was meant to be a lawyer, said Jane. There was something wry and sad in her voice that Celeste couldn't quite interpret. They turned down the grassy laneway that led past a little white weatherboard house that almost seemed to be part of the school. I wasn't really enjoying it, said Celeste. Was this true? She had hated the stress. She ran late every day. But didn't she once love some aspects of it? The careful untangling of a legal issue? Like math, but with words. I couldn't go back to practicing law, said Celeste, not with the boys. Sometimes I think I might do teaching, teach legal studies, but I'm not sure that really appeals either. She had lost her nerve for work, like she'd lost her nerve for skiing. Jane was silent. She was probably thinking that Celeste was a spoiled trophy wife. I'm lucky, said Celeste. I don't have to work. Perry is, well, he's a hedge fund manager. Now she sounded show-offy, when she'd meant to sound grateful. Conversations with women about work could be so fraught. If Madeline had been there, she would have said, Perry earns a shitload, so Celeste can live a life of leisure. And then she would have done a typical Madeline about face and said something about how bringing up twin boys wasn't exactly a life of leisure and that Celeste probably worked harder than Perry. Perry liked Madeline. Feisty, he called her. I have to start doing some sort of exercise routine while Ziggy is at school, said Jane. I'm so unfit. I get breathless going up a tiny slope. It's terrible. Everyone around here is so fit and healthy. I'm not, said Celeste. I do no exercise at all. Madeline is always after me to go to the gym with her. She's crazy for those classes, but I hate gyms. Me too, said Jane with a grimace. Big, sweaty men. We should go walking together when the kids are at school, said Celeste. Around the headland. Jane gave her a quick, shy, surprised smile. I'd love that. Harper. You know how Jane and Celeste were supposedly great friends? Well, obviously it wasn't all roses, because I did overhear something at the trivia night, quite by accident. It must have been only minutes before it happened. I was going out on the balcony to get some fresh air. Well, to have a cigarette, if you must know, because I had a number of things on my mind. Anyway, Jane and Celeste were out there, and Celeste was saying, "I'm sorry. I'm just so, so sorry." It was about an hour before school pickup when Samira, Madeline's boss at the Pirawee Theatre, called to discuss marketing for the new production of King Lear. Just before she hung up, finally, Madeline didn't get paid for the time she spent on these phone calls, and if her boss offered to pay, she'd have said no, but still, it would have been nice to have had the opportunity to graciously refuse. Samira mentioned that she had a whole stack of complimentary front row Disney on Ice tickets if Madeline wanted them. "When for?" asked Madeline, looking at her wall calendar. "Let's see. Saturday, February the 28th, 2 p.m. The box on the calendar was empty, but there was something familiar about the date. Madeline reached for her handbag and pulled out the pink envelope that Chloe had given her that morning. Amabella's A party was at 2 p.m, Saturday, February the 28th. Madeline smiled. "I'd love them." Thea. The invitations for Amabella's party went out first. And then, next thing, that very same afternoon, Madeline is handing out free tickets for Disney on Ice. Like she's Lady Muck. Samantha. Those tickets cost a fortune and Lily was so desperate to go. I didn't realize it was the same day as Amabella's party. But then again, Lily didn't know Amabella from a bar of soap. So I felt bad. But not that bad. Jonathan. I always said the best part of being a stay-at-home dad was leaving behind all the office politics. Then, first day of school, I get caught up in some war between these two women. Bonnie. We went to Amabella's party. I think Madeline forgot to offer us one of the Disney tickets. I'm sure it was just an oversight. Detective Sergeant Adrian Quinlan. We're talking to parents about everything that went on at that school. I can assure you it wouldn't be the first time that a dispute over a seemingly inconsequential matter led to violence. Chapter 22. Celeste and Perry sat on the couch drinking red wine, eating Lindt chocolate balls, and watching their third episode in a row of The Walking Dead. The boys were sound asleep. The house was quiet, except for the crunch of footsteps coming from the television. The main character was creeping through the forest, his knife drawn. A zombie appeared from behind a tree, her face black and rotting, her teeth snapping, making that guttural sound that zombies apparently make. Celeste and Perry both jumped and screamed. Perry spilled some of his red wine. Perry dabbed at the splash of wine on his t-shirt. "That scared the life out of me." The man on the screen drove his knife through the zombie's skull. "Gotcha," said Celeste. "Pause it while I get us a refill," said Perry. Celeste picked up the remote and paused the DVD. "This is even better than last season." "I know," said Perry, "although I think it gives me bad dreams." He brought over the bottle of wine from the sideboard. "Are we going to some kid's birthday party tomorrow?" he asked as he refilled her glass. "I ran into Mark Whittaker at Catalina's today, and he seemed to think we were going. He said the mother mentioned we were invited. Renata somebody? Actually, did I meet a Renata that day when I went to the school with you?" "You did," said Celeste. We were invited to Amabella's party, but we're not going. She wasn't concentrating. That was the problem. She didn't have time to prepare. She was enjoying the wine, chocolate, and zombies. Perry had only gotten back less than a week ago. He was always so loving and chipper after a trip, especially if he'd left the country. It somehow cleansed him. His face always seemed smoother, his eyes brighter. The layers of frustration would take weeks to build up again. The children had been in feral little moods tonight. "Mummy gets a rest tonight," Perry told the boys earlier, and he'd done the whole bath, teeth, story routine on his own, while she sat on the couch, reading her book and drinking a Perry Surprise. It was a cocktail he'd invented years ago. It tasted of chocolate and cream and strawberries and cinnamon, and every woman he ever prepared it for went crazy over it. "I'll give you my children in return for that recipe," Madeline had once told Perry. Perry filled his own glass. "Why aren't we going?" "I'm taking the boys to Disney on Ice. Madeline got free tickets, and a group of us are going." Celeste broke off another piece of chocolate. She'd texted her apologies to Renata and hadn't heard back. As the nanny did most of the school pickups and drop-offs, Celeste hadn't run into her since the first day of school. She knew she was aligning herself with Madeline and Jane by saying no, but, well, she was aligned with Madeline and Jane, and this was a fifth birthday party. This was not a matter of life or death. "So I'm not welcome at this Disney thing," said Perry. He sipped his wine. She felt it then, in her stomach, a tiny squeeze. But his tone was casual, humorous. If she trod carefully, she might still save the night. She put down the chocolate. "Sorry," she said. "I thought you'd appreciate a bit of alone time. You can go to the gym." Perry stood above her with the wine bottle still in his hand. He smiled. "I've been away for 4 weeks. I'm away again on Friday. Why would I need alone time?" He didn't sound or look angry, but she could feel something in the atmosphere, like an electrical charge before a storm. The hairs on her arms stood up. "I'm sorry," she said. I didn't think..." "You sick of me already?" He looked hurt. He was hurt. She'd been thoughtless. She should have known better. Perry was always looking for evidence that she didn't really love him. It was like he expected it, and then he was angry when he believed himself proven right. She went to stand up from the couch, but that would turn it into a confrontation. Sometimes, if she behaved normally, she could gently nudge them back on track. Instead, she looked up at him. "The boys don't even know this little girl. And I hardly ever take them to see live shows. It just seemed like this was the better option." "Well, why don't you take them to live shows?" said Perry. "We don't need free tickets. Why don't you tell Madeline to give the tickets to someone who would really appreciate them?" I don't know, it wasn't about money, really." She hadn't thought of that. She was depriving some other mother of a free ticket. She should have thought of the fact that Perry would be back and he'd want to spend time with the boys, but he was away so often she was used to making social arrangements that suited her. "I'm sorry," she said calmly. She was sorry, but it was fruitless because he would never believe her. "I probably should have chosen the party." She stood up. "I'm going to take my contacts out. My eyes are itchy." She went to walk past him. He grabbed her upper arm. His fingers dug into the flesh. "Hey," she said, "that hurts." It was part of the game that her initial reaction was always one of outrage and surprise, as if this had never happened before, as if he maybe didn't know what he was doing. He gripped harder. Don't, she said. Perry, just don't. The pain ignited her anger. The anger was always there, a reservoir of flammable fuel. She heard her voice turn high and hysterical, a shrieking, shrewish woman. Perry, this is not a big deal. Don't turn everything into a big deal. Because now it was no longer about the party. Now it was about every other time. His hand tightened further. It looked like he was making a decision, exactly how much to hurt her. It hurt, but not that much. He shoved her, just hard enough so that she staggered back clumsily. Then he took a step back and lifted his chin, breathing heavily through his nostrils, his arms hanging loosely by his side. He waited to see what she'd do next. There were so many options. Sometimes she tried to respond like an adult. That is unacceptable. Sometimes she yelled. Sometimes she walked away. Sometimes she fought back. She punched and kicked him the way she'd once punched and kicked her older brother. For a few moments he would let her, as if it were what he wanted, as if it were what he needed, before he grabbed her wrists. She wasn't the only one who woke up the next day with bruises. She'd seen them on Perry's body. She was as bad as he was, as sick as he was. "I don't care who started it," she said to the children. None of the options were effective. "I will leave you if you ever do that again," she said after the first time, and she was deadly serious. My God, she was serious. She knew exactly how she was meant to behave in a situation like this. The boys were only 8 months old. Perry cried. She cried. He promised. He swore on his children's lives. He was heartbroken. He bought her the first piece of jewelry she would never wear. A week after the twins had their second birthday, it happened again. Worse than the first time. She was devastated. The marriage was over. She was going to leave. There was no doubt at all. But that very night, both boys woke up with terrible coughs. It was croup. The next day, Josh got so sick, their GP said, "I'm calling an ambulance." Josh was in intensive care for 3 nights. The tender purple bruises on Celeste's left hip were laughably irrelevant when a doctor stood in front of her saying gently, "We think we should intubate." All she'd wanted was for Josh to be okay. And then he was okay, sitting up in his bed, demanding the Wiggles and his brother in a voice still husky from that awful tube. She and Perry were euphoric with relief. And a few days after they brought Josh home from the hospital, Perry left for Hong Kong, and the moment for dramatic action had passed. And the unassailable fact that underlay all her indecisiveness was this. She loved Perry. She was still in love with him. She still had a crush on him. He still made her happy and made her laugh. She still enjoyed talking with him, watching TV with him, lying in bed with him on cold, rainy mornings. She still wanted him. But each time she didn't leave, she gave him tacit permission to do it again. She knew this. She was an educated woman with choices, places to go, family and friends who would gather around, lawyers who would represent her. She could go back to work and support herself. She wasn't frightened that he'd kill her if she tried to leave. She wasn't frightened that he'd take the children away from her. One of the school mums, Gabrielle, often chatted with Celeste in the playground after school while her son and Celeste's boys played ninjas. "I'm starting a new diet tomorrow," she told Celeste yesterday. "I probably won't stick to it, and then I'll be all filled with self-loathing." She looked Celeste up and down and said, "You've got no idea what I'm talking about, do you, skinny Minnie?" "Actually, I do," Celeste thought. I know exactly what you mean. Now she pressed her hand to her upper arm and battled the desire to cry. She wouldn't be able to wear that sleeveless dress tomorrow now. I don't know why. She stopped. I don't know why I stay. I don't know why I deserve this. I don't know why you do this, why we do this, why this keeps happening.
Celeste, he said hoarsely, and she could see the violence draining from his body.
The DVD started again. Perry picked up the remote and turned off the television.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
His face sagged with regret. It was over now. There would be no further recriminations about the party. In fact, the very opposite. He'd be tender and solicitous. For the next few days, up until he left for his trip, no woman would be more cherished than Celeste. Part of her would enjoy it, the tremulous, teary, righteous feeling of being wronged. She let her hand drop from her arm. It could have been so much worse. He rarely hit her face. She'd never broken a limb or needed stitches. Her bruises could always be kept secret with a turtleneck, or sleeves, or long pants. He would never lay a finger on the children. The boys never saw. It could be worse. Oh, so much worse. She'd read the articles about proper domestic violence victims. That was terrible. That was real. What Perry did didn't count. It was small stuff, which made it all the more humiliating because it was so tacky, so childish and trite. He didn't cheat on her. He didn't gamble. He didn't drink to excess. He didn't ignore her like the way her father had ignored her mother. That would be the worst, to be ignored, to not be seen. Perry's rage was an illness, a mental illness. She saw the way it took hold of him, how he tried his best to resist. When he was in the throes of it, his eyes became red and glassy, as if he were drugged. The things he said didn't even make sense. It wasn't him. The rage wasn't him. Would she leave him if he got a brain tumor and the tumor affected his personality? Of course she wouldn't. This was just a glitch in an otherwise perfect relationship. Every relationship had its glitches. Its ups, its downs. It was like motherhood. Every morning the boys climbed into bed with her for a cuddle, and at first it was heavenly, and then after about 10 minutes or so they started fighting, and it was terrible. Her boys were gorgeous little darlings. Her boys were feral little animals. She would never leave Perry any more than she could leave the boys. Perry held out his arms. Celeste? She turned her head, took a step away, but there was no one else there to comfort her. There was only him, the real him. She stepped forward and laid her head against his chest. Samantha, I'll never forget the moment when Perry and Celeste walked into the trivia night. There was like this ripple across the room. Everyone just stopped and stared. Chapter 23. Isn't this fantastic? Cried Madeline to Chloe as they took their really very excellent seats in front of the giant ice rink. You can feel the cold from the ice. Brrr. Oh, can you hear the music? I wonder where the princess is. Chloe had reached over and placed one hand gently over her mother's mouth. Shh. Madeline knew she was talking too much because she was feeling anxious and ever so slightly guilty. Today needed to be stupendous to make it worth the rift she'd created between herself and Renata. 8 kindergarten children who would otherwise be attending Amabella's party were here watching Disney on Ice because of Madeline. Madeline looked past Chloe at Ziggy, who was nursing a giant stuffed toy on his lap. Ziggy was the reason they were here today, she reminded herself. Poor Ziggy wouldn't have been at the party. Dear little fatherless Ziggy, who was possibly a secret psychopathic bully, but still.
Are you taking care of Harry the Hippo this weekend, Ziggy? She said brightly.
Harry the Hippo was the class toy. Every weekend it went home with a different child, along with a scrapbook that had to be returned with a little story about the weekend, accompanied by photos. Ziggy nodded mutely. A child of few words. Jane leaned forward, discreetly chewing gum as always. It's quite stressful having Harry to stay. We have to give Harry a good time. Last weekend, he went on a roller coaster. Ow! Jane flinched as one of the twins, who was sitting next to her and fighting his brother, elbowed her in the back of the head. Josh! Said Celeste sharply. Max! Just stop it! Madeline wondered if Celeste was okay today. She looked pale and tired, with purplish shadows under her eyes. Although on Celeste, they looked like an artful makeup effect that everyone should try. The lights in the auditorium began to dim, and then went to black. Chloe clutched Madeline's arm. The music began to pound, so loud that Madeline could feel the vibrations. The ice rink filled with an array of colourful, swooping, whirling Disney characters. Madeline looked down the row of seats at her stolen guests, their profiles illuminated by the blazing spotlights on the ice. Every child was looking straight ahead, little back straight, enthralled by the spectacle in front of them. And every parent had turned to look at their child's profile, enchanted by their enchantment. Except for Celeste, who had dropped her head and pressed her hand to her forehead. I have to leave him. Sometimes when she was thinking about something else, the thought came into her head with the shock and the force of a flying fist. My husband hits me. God almighty, what was wrong with her? All that insane rationalizing. A glitch, for God's sake. Of course she had to leave. Today, right now, as soon as they got home from the show, she would pack her bags. But the boys would be so tired and grumpy. It was fantastic, said Jane to her mother, who had called up to ask how Disney on Ice went. Ziggy loved it. He says he wants to learn how to ice skate. Your grandfather loved to ice skate, said her mother triumphantly. There you go, said Jane, not bothering to tell her mother that every single child had announced after the show that they now wanted to learn how to ice skate. Not just those with past lives. Well, and you'll never guess who I ran into at the shops today, said her mother. Ruth Sullivan. Did you? Said Jane, wondering if this was the real reason for the call. Ruth was her ex-boyfriend's mother. How's Zack? She asked dutifully as she unwrapped a new piece of gum. Fine, said her mother. He's engaged, darling. Is he? Said Jane. She slipped the gum in her mouth and chewed, wondering how she felt about that. But there was something else distracting her now, a tiny possibility of a tiny catastrophe. She began walking around their messy apartment, picking up cushions and discarded clothes. I wasn't sure I should tell you, said her mother. I know it was a long time ago, but he did break your heart. He didn't break my heart, said Jane vaguely. He did break her heart, but he broke it so gently so respectfully and regretfully, the way a nice, well-brought-up 19-year-old boy did break your heart when he wanted to go on a Contiki tour of Europe and sleep with lots of girls. When she thought about Zach now, it was like remembering an old